according to the Buddhist traditions, there's this idea that the tests and trials of our life are sent down to us as messengers from the gods. That we birth, our aging, sickness and death, these kinds of things which we're confronted with are not something to be regretted or complained about. It's not an opportunity for whinging, it's not an opportunity for thinking something's gone wrong. Instead, it's an opportunity for the growth of wisdom. And so these things are felt to be divine messengers. And the things that we do as part of our regular Buddhist practice is whenever these kinds of afflictions come to us, and when we get sick, we have an accident, something goes wrong in our life, then we don't take that as a chance to complain, to blame, to point the figure. We don't get upset about it. We don't get remorseful or vengeful or anything like that. But we just reflect on it and accept it. The way these things are described in the suttas is very kind of quite poignant and to the point. You know, it talks about aging, for example, and has these kind of words like the breaking of the teeth, something I can identify with very closely. My own teeth are almost completely broken by now. I regularly cut my tongue on the sharp bits where my teeth are broken. Despite the fact that I've been in and out of dentists constantly since I was a child, or perhaps one might more cynically say because of the fact I've been in and out of dentists since I was a child. And you can feel where teeth are just breaking up. The wrinkling of the skin. The graying of the hair. So these things are divine messengers, they're signs of wisdom, or they should be signs of wisdom. We still have this idea in our society, even though we have such an unusually youth-orientated society and culture, we still have this idea of the elder as being sagely or worthy of respect because of the wisdom they've learnt during their life. Unfortunately, however, age does not necessarily bring wisdom. And if one does not apply oneself to developing wisdom when young and in the middle years of life, then it's quite possible that you get old and be old and stupid. And that's something that's very sad. If someone has gone through the whole of their life, at the end of their life, not only is their body breaking up, their faculties are starting to deteriorate. The enjoyments which they're able to have when they're young, they can't enjoy anymore. And yet, They haven't learnt anything. I've seen a few cases like this. Sometimes when I'm asked to go and visit people who are dying in hospital, and very often you can see people do have some wisdom and acceptance of what's happening, but in other cases you don't. You know, the cases people have, they're on their deathbed and they really haven't learned anything. And if they were to get a reprieve from their deathbed, to be put into a young body again, they'd just go and do exactly the same stupid things that they did in the first place. So this is called getting old and stupid. The technical term. So hopefully we would like to avoid this if possible. Getting old is okay, but old and stupid is pathetic. When I was with Venerable Dhamma Vihari, he was talking about this, the idea of aging and saging. He was really into it. So the idea that old age is a time to of wisdom, a time for reflective contemplation and understanding of the whole cycle of life. I think this is a quite nice way of looking at it. Similarly with sickness, you know, we all experience illness at one time or another, and you can see people do respond to that in very, very different ways. Somebody like our friend Jana, who got very sick with brain cancer when she was a young girl, and the experience was such a shock for her, but she had a dharmic environment and responded to that, and so she used that as a chance for developing wisdom which is way beyond her years, and has transformed that experience into something she can use to help others. Other cases, people just get sick and bitter, resentful, feel depressed, feel hopeless. It's not easy, it's something you have to struggle with. When we get sick even for a short period of time, it's quite depressing to sit in a hospital and not be able to do anything. To lie in a sick bed, just be attended on by people. So we have to be prepared for that. We have to learn to accept it. One of the aspects of the the holy life, that the lifestyle of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in some ways prepares us for that, because it requires us to be in some ways dependent, say for food, the requisites. And so although there is a strong ethic of responsibility and maturity in the Sangha, at the same time there's a recognition of the idea of dependence, both dependence on a teacher within the Sangha, but also dependence on the lay community for material things. And so that's like a combination of dependence and independence. And that's how life is. You know, the reality is that we can't be completely dependent or completely independent. James Lattay told the story when he was trekking in Nepal, and they were going with a group climbing up the mountains. And when they were staying in one of the tea houses, they would stay along the route, and there was this Swiss couple, both kind of strong and tall and sort of got all the latest equipment and the gear for mountaineering and so on. And they were staying in the guest tea house as well. And the leader of James's group said, "Oh, we're going climbing up tomorrow. If you'd like to come with us, you know, you can come, we can help each other." And they said, apparently very, very proud and said, no, we're independent trekkers. So they were so proud of themselves because they were independent. And James was just kind of laughing at this idea because, of course, there they were in the tea house. Somebody's making dinner for them. Somebody's making a cup of tea for them. Somebody's cleaned their bed for them, prepared the place, built the building they were staying in, made the paths they were walking along. And they're actually completely dependent. Somebody's designed the equipment that they're using. Somebody's paid them the money that they're using to pay for all this. They're completely dependent every step of the way, and they have a pride about independence. So dependence and independence is always relative in Buddhism. You don't have this idea of, that sometimes you find in Christian monasticism of being like childishly in an immature way, not being able to make up your own mind or have an independent opinion or do anything by yourself. That kind of dependence is not part of Buddhism. But neither is the idea that we could just be have this delusion that somehow we live as an island and can be isolated from others. So when we're sick, we experience this dependence on others. It's quite hard to do. It's good practice. There's a humility there. There's a grace there to be able to accept that with ease, with politeness, with dignity. Of course, the other great divine messenger is the dead person. And this is quite a strong inversion of our normal perceptions, because normally a dead person is seen as being almost like taboo, as something horrifying about it. We feel uncomfortable in the presence of death. We don't want to touch a dead body. We don't want to see it. We don't want to be near it. Smells, looks horrible, the idea of it is horrible, the thought of it is horrible. So this is a complete re-evaluation of the notion of a dead person, a corpse, that is actually a messenger from the gods, something for us to learn from. So we should always take that opportunity when we have the chance. At a funeral, or with the bones we have in the monastery, we have bones we can contemplate. Where in Asian countries, where we can still see the traditional funeral arrangements and burning the cremation, see the body on the cremation pyre, and so on. And we should always take those opportunities. We should regard it as a blessing. We should be grateful for the chance to see this divine messenger. But of course it's not enough just to see it, but you also need to reflect. And as it says throughout the suttas, when it's talking about this, ayampiko kayo evang dhammo evang bhavietam manatitoti, this body too is of the same dhamma, the same nature, which does not go beyond that. Very, very important phrase. Don't miss that chance. So these are the divine messengers as seen or conceived in the Buddhist tradition. And what's probably less well known or is that there are other kinds of divine messengers as well. And one of the the other divine messengers that appeared was the dancing girls. in the Bodhisattva's harem. And of course you all know the story that Siddhartha is a prince, so they say, in the Sakyan clan, was endowed with a harem, or given a harem of dancing girls who sort of stayed in the palace with musicians and dancers and so on. It says euphemistically. I'm sure they got up to a bit more than playing songs and dancing. And no men among them, only women there. And so, of course, from this can be seen from a number of different points of view. From Siddhartha's point of view, or from the traditional point of view of the narrative, it's something which has this sort of the purpose of that the story is to say that when the dancing girls all fell asleep, that they were kind of drooling and dishevelled and so on, and that the Bodhisattva felt repulsed. But to say he felt repulsed is only the part of the story, because of course the very fact of the repulsion is dependent on the sense of attraction, right? So there's a kind of peculiar sense of kind of balance of both desire and revulsion, which is actually a very very kind of realistic psychology. And one of the interesting things is that the same scene with the dancing girls is presented both in the Buddha story as something that causes revulsion, but in other places in Indian literature, like in the Ramayana, exactly the same scene is presented, but it's not a cause for repulsion, but a cause for attraction. You know, they're described in just a slightly different nuance, but it's something that is very desirable. So this is kind of peculiar edge of both attraction and repulsion which is going on there. It's a very potent scene. So of course from another point of view, then you could look at that and say, well, that's a kind of classic example of the objectification of women, that the women's bodies are seen as being objects. They only exist for the purpose of causing the Bodhisattva to go forth. They aren't anybody in themselves. There's no subjectivity to those dancing girls. No one cares how they feel. No one cares what they think. No one cares what they say. Those things are irrelevant to the story. They're not regarded as independent humans with their own dignity, with their own intelligence. They're only regarded as a foil for the going forth of the Bodhisattva. And so that critique, I think, is very true, and I think it's a fair enough critique. But it's also interesting that the very fact that they were said to be divine messengers, in a way, almost undercuts or relativizes that position again, because they really are just appearance. They're being objectified as being just, you know, the appearance of the Bodhisattva, but that's in fact what they really are. They in fact don't have any subjectivity. They in fact don't have any dignity. They're just a mirage. They're just an image. So this is the way that the Buddhist texts kind of play with these ideas. Sort of treating them in quite a light way. There's a sense of playfulness about the way that these things are treated. You don't quite know what's happening and what's not happening, what's real and what's not real. So if we were to think about this notion of the divine messengers and this notion of the those things which appear or occur in our life which can teach us, depending on our attitude or our response to it. Then that gives us a that gives us something to joke about, doesn't it? If somebody pisses us off, and oh, thank you, you must be a messenger from the gods sent down to test me. All the things that go wrong were sent down by the gods in order to test us, to remind us. If things don't go wrong, if the computers work properly, if the people bringing dana show up on time every day, if the cave isn't damp, then we get too complacent. We need to have those obstacles to keep on overcoming and keep on reminding ourselves that this is the reality of life. But also, the notion of divine messengers, it does have also that nuance. Because, ironically enough, it's a message about the reality of life, but it's not actually real. This is, I think, the fascinating thing about the notion of divine messengers. The old man, the sick man, the dead man, these are all messages of the inevitable reality of life, which every person is subject to. But in fact, it's not. In fact, it's just a manifestation by a deity. It's not a real old man, a real sick man, a real dead man at all. It's just a show. It's just a game. And so the last of the divine messengers which appeared to Siddhartha was, of course, the sadhu, the monk, walking along, and somebody is a very kind of potent symbol. And of course, according to the story, Siddhartha approached them and said, "You know, what are you doing?" And they said, "Well, I've just left the home life to do what is good. Practice what is good." So that's a very inspiring idea. If we're just confronted with, you know, the old man, the sick man, the dead man, then that, of course, can be very negative, can be a bit depressing. If we're just confronted with the vanity and emptiness of worldly pleasures, then life can become meaningless. So the important thing, the essence of the thing, is that there is also an alternative, there's an escape, there's something else. This is really important. Many years ago I read there was a book, The Great Thoughts of Humanity. And I thought, oh, well, I'll see if the Buddha makes it into here. And I looked in there and I found under the Buddha, it said the Buddha's two great thoughts. One, there is suffering. Two, there is an origin of suffering. That was it. The two noble truths. Which I don't actually regard as particularly great thoughts. It's sort of mediocre thoughts. But it's the last two, the end of suffering and the path to the end of suffering. These are the truly great thoughts. So the sight of the samana, the samana dasana, is is something which opens up a possibility. It's why it's such a powerful image, you know. And you know, no matter what you want to say about it, monastic life and all the various problems with it and so on. Yes, of course, if you want to, you know, think about and point to all the corruption in the Sangha and all the disappointment, all the ways that it doesn't live up to its ideal, then of course there are many, many things that we can say about that. But at the end of the day, there's still something very powerful about that ideal, that image. It's not recognized only within Buddhism and by Buddhist faithful, but very generally across the world you see this image like constantly being presented as an image of peace, of tranquility, of some possibility of another way of life, another way of being that's more in accord with what is good. And so that's why this notion of the Sangha and the ordained Sangha will never be replaced. You'll never have an entirely secularized form of Buddhism developing, because it simply doesn't have the same impact. The idea of lay meditation teachers and so on and so forth is all very good. They perform a very wonderful service, and in many cases they probably teach Dhamma as well as or better than monastics can. But that image, that symbol, the nun or the monk with the robe, the shaven head, that idea of having just let go, genuinely let go on a deep level of the worldly pretensions, worldly attitudes, worldly values. That's something which, ironically enough, the world values tremendously. So the world needs that counterbalance. It needs to believe that it's possible. In the description of wrong view and right view that we from the Salaika Sutta, you know, so one of the things is that there is sort of a nihilistic point of view, is that there is no one who has really realized the truth. I mean, there's no really genuine, you know, ascetics or samanas. This is a cynical point of view. But actually for most people there's a feeling of a need to recognize this. It was sort of commented on ironically by a Christian ascetic of some kind, I'm not sure what tradition he was from, but he lived in a hermitage in WA, somewhere in the northwest of WA, and there was an interview with him in the paper, and he was saying how strange he always found it, that here he was living in the desert and by himself, that people would come to him all of that way to ask him advice on how to cope with their marriage. Well, how to deal with their worldly problems and so on. And he's like, well, I'm the last person who knows about those things. So there's a sense in which you can, for example, when people do come to monastics for advice and counselling and so on, they come for a different kind of thing. So say if you go to a psychologist or a counsellor or a social worker or something, and they have a kind of knowledge which is derived from certain kinds of sources. So for example, it's derived from, say, studies, empirical surveys, statistics, and so on. And that can give certain information regarding, you know, what's the best way to proceed and so on. And they can learn, for example, that if you do a certain kind of counselling in a certain situation, that you have a certain percentage of people that it will improve to a certain degree, and you can quantify all those things. They come to monastics, we don't quantify things at all. But what they do find when they come to monastics is that there's a completely different perspective. There's a different way of seeing things. There's a different way of being. And that different way of being isn't necessarily going to solve their problems, but it's going to give some perspective to them. So this is the role which I think that the Sangha has, and which we should, you know, be cultivating that perception within us, is that like within the Sangha or the ordained Sangha, is that we can't, we're not about trying to, you know, compete with you know, people with very kind of specialties and so on. We don't have to learn all of those the same things. We're providing something different, and we're embodying something different, a different way of being, a different way of living, a different way of thinking, a different set of values. And that different set of values is not it's not something which you can sort of make a list of. Well, you can if you like, you can make a list of them, you know, contentment and letting go and all of those things. So you can make a list of them, but you won't capture them through the list. They're just pointers, they're indicators. It's something which we need to be constantly questioning ourselves and constantly trying to embody within ourselves in terms of what is the best way, the most authentic way, the most real way, the most compassionate way to respond in this particular circumstance. So it's developing a sense of aliveness and responsiveness to circumstances as they present themselves. And so, of course, one of the great qualities that helps us to do that is the quality of mindfulness. Yeah? So mindfulness, being in the present moment. If you're with somebody, being with that person. If you're doing a task, being with that task. If you're sitting to meditate, being with that meditation. If you're reading a book, being with that book. If you're eating a meal, being with that eating. If you're going to the toilet, being with that. Whatever you're doing at the time, doing that to the best of your ability every time. So in that way, as monastics, as Sangha members, and those who are aspiring or interested to join the Sangha, then we try to develop an inner life, an inner set of qualities and virtues, which will reflect those which are projected upon us. That's one of the things that we find that's a cause of quite a lot of stress and difficulty among monastics, is the fact that we do provide very much a blank slate for people to project what they want to on. Okay, so this kind of people project all kinds of ideals and stereotypes and so on. And almost we encourage that by sort of taking away the individual, you know, clothes and dressing, we all wear the same robes and so on. We kind of invite, we're participating in this archetype, and we're inviting that kind of projection. And people from different cultural backgrounds will expect you to behave in certain ways because you're a monk or because you're a nun. They'll assume that you have various kinds of psychic powers, that you can read their minds. They'll assume that you can meditate in such and such a way, they'll be surprised to find out that you, you know, do worldly things like, you know, some people quite extraordinary like that. They say, oh, you know, didn't know you could drink coffee or something like that. So they'll be surprised to find out that you can do things like that. It's always good to cultivate a few little peccadilloes to kind of remind yourself and others of these kind of imperfections. So it's quite, it becomes quite demanding or quite difficult for us within ourselves, because we know that we don't very often live up to the expectations that are placed upon us. And we also know that we should be careful and very ethical in not playing up to that, and not trying to pretend to be something that we're not. That's what the, especially in the Parajika rule about lying about supernormal attainments or spiritual attainments. But even on a more subtle level, we shouldn't try to get anywhere or get anything that we want by playing up to those kinds of ideas. That we should be very, it should be like a reminder of humility to when we're wearing the robe, to remember all of the great nuns, the great monks who have worn these robes beforehand, and their attainments and their spiritual the spiritual heights that they've reached, and which we are so far beneath, that we feel very humble that we can't, we aspire to reach that kind of level. So if we're feeling like there's too much of a gulf between these expectations and the reality, then that can be quite stressful. So the response to that is to ensure that we're moving in that direction as much as possible. We can't be something that we're not. We should not expect ourselves to be perfect. We should not expect others to be perfect. We should not expect other samanas to be perfect. We should not expect that only perfect people should ordain. If you're perfect already, you don't have to ordain. Don't bother, just go and hang out on the beach at Byron Bay. Be perfect. That's what I do. So, if we have a sense of sincerity, authenticity in what we're doing, then we'll have a sense of moving towards, so the reality is moving towards that sort of archetype of perfection. And as long as that's the case, then we're okay. Doesn't matter how fast or how slow it is. Okay, so the Buddha said he only prays progress in good dhammas, not decline and not even standing still, but gradually moving forward little bit by little bit. So it doesn't matter too much how fast you're going. Okay, obviously faster is better, alright? If you can get enlightened this week, it's better than getting enlightened next week. But doesn't matter too much, as long as you're actually moving in the right direction. Gradually realizing, making real that inner subjective reality which will be in harmony with the external projection that we create as samanas. And so, interestingly enough, to come back to this idea of the divine messengers as being an illusion, a magic trick from the gods, in a sense that's what we are as bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, that we are projecting an illusion. As long as we're not enlightened, we're projecting a kind of an image, which is an image of a sage. And maybe we're not very sagely at all, maybe we're full of defilements and foolishness and stupidity. And so in a sense we are like the gods that were projecting these images that weren't real. We're also projecting images which to some degree are not real, but we're moving towards that reality. And how interestingly that when when that time comes and when we do realize enlightenment, that at that time the illusion finishes and it becomes the reality. The image, the projection, is actually the external perception and projection is actually the same as the internal experience. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the divine messengers. So I offer that to you for your encouragement, and to invite any comments or questions.